So I'm now in Seattle, and do you want to introduce yourself?
All right, I'm Jen, or Rogue, as most people tend to call me. I recently moved up to the Seattle area from Austin, Texas. You know, most of my recent, like, organizing stuff has been in Austin and stuff, so, but I, since moving up here, I've been working with some folks on establishing an organization called Class Action Alliance, which would be based out of Washington and Oregon.
Let's start with Seattle. What can you tell us about the city of Seattle?
To me, it's really big. I think that there's a lot of, like, sort of mythology around Seattle and, like, what it's like based on the WTO protests from, you know, what, 8 years ago now. But in my impression from spending time off and on here is that the sort of radical community here is kind of, like, scattered, and there's not a lot of there's not a whole lot of networking and, like, and coalition building going on, which I noticed there was a, there's an organization in California called Critical Resistance, which is a prison abolitionist organization, and their 10th anniversary conference is coming up in September, and so they've been doing these meetings around the country to talk to people, to mobilize them to come to the conference, and they have one in Seattle, and the turnout was huge. I mean, people, it's like, anyone who's, you know, affected, their organizing is somehow affected by prison and, like, and, you know, came to this meeting, and there was, like, probably 40 people at it, and my impression, I mean, you know, as an outsider, was that most of the people in the room didn't know each other, and, like, all, you know, there's all these people, like, you know, there was IWW folks there was people from the Communities Against Rape and Abuse, a really awesome local anti-violence organization, you know, there's, like, all these people from all these different, like, youth organizations and Latino organizations and all this stuff, but there's, you know, a few people were friends in the room, but there wasn't, like, this looked like, to me, to be the first time a lot of these people were talking to each other, and so that was my, you know, I'm from the South, where, you know, everyone had to work together because there was four leftists in the entire city, and so, you know, it's really interesting to see, I think, maybe, because it's such a big city with so much going on, networking is sort of limited, unfortunately.
And in terms of issues in the city, what would you identify?
The big one that I hear the most about is gentrification, you know, which is kind of like the classic issue in almost every North American major city, which there's actually a good article in a recent issue of Eat the State, which is like an anti-authoritarian, like, mag. That's what most people were talking about in that particular meeting, is that there's a lot of, like, youth profiling of, you know, like, you know, youth are in gangs and the cops are, you know, just, you know, coming around so much more so because of all the gentrification that's happening. And so that's, like, that definitely is, like, the big issue that I hear people talking about a lot. And then I think another, you know, big issue for a lot of people around here and in the Northwest in general is, like, environmental activism and that kind of thing, which I feel, like, a little less connected to recently anyway. There's, like, my perspective on it as a Southerner is very different than I think a lot of Northwestern perspectives on environmentalism. But, you know, other than that, I think it's got a lot of the same problems that any, like, big city in North America has. You know, police brutality, like, public housing is abysmal here. One of my friends is a public housing, you know, organizer, and she's, like, when she travels the country talking to other public housing organizers and other people fighting for housing rights and tenants' rights, you know, they're all amazed at how horrible Seattle is about it. So that seems to be, like, a really major problem.
When you say horrible, like, what?
They don't have public housing. You know, it's really, like, you know, there's not really tenants' rights organizations here the way there are, I feel like, in other places. This is my impression from my friend, is that, you know, just there's not as much, like, grassroots organizing of, like, poor tenants and that kind of thing. Yeah, so it's got, you know, I'm still learning, too, like, what's going on, and get into the city as much as I can and sort of try to get an idea of what people are focused on.
And in terms of a kind of anarchist movement in Seattle, what exists in terms of infrastructure or anything else? I mean, there's Left Bank Books, but
I think Left Bank is, like, kind of a staple in many ways. Like, it's really consistent. It's been around for 25 years, I think?
35
years, yeah. Like, you know, it's been around for forever, but because it's just a bookstore, like, they don't have room for meeting space, I think that it tends, you know, it's definitely an asset to the community, but it doesn't necessarily lend itself to organizing very much. My impression from, like, you know, over the years just sort of dropping in for a few months at a time of Seattle is that there's kind of, like, a high turnover rate for anarchists here. I think that there's, like, a lot of people don't really stick with this town. Like, you know, last time I was here, it was, like, 5 years ago, and none of the people that lived here 5 years ago are still here. You know, you know. So I think that, and I think that some of that has to do with it being a college town, and so people leave when they're done with school or something. Plus, it rains 9 months out of the year, and so a lot of people want to split. But I think that that's, you know, what I've seen is, like, not a whole lot of consistency with organizing. Like, people, I've definitely met some really awesome folks, and there's some, like, places that have been around. Like, there was a house called the Pumpkin House that had some, you know, I don't know if it's still around, but, you know, that place was, like, around every time I visited for a long time, that had some really solid organizers in it, and, like, but, you know, that, yeah, my impression has definitely been that, like, there hasn't, which I've seen in many other cities as well, is that, you know, there's kind of, like, a turnover rate, and so there's not a lot of, like, consistent projects that have been around for 10 years, really, or anything like that.
It's a theme I'm running into in many of the cities, is this idea of people only being around for a short while, mm-hmm. and then moving on. And actually, it's something that's probably worth discussing, I think, with you in particular. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we had a conversation about how you used to do the freight train
mm-hmm.
way back. Do you want to start by explaining that? Because I think a lot of people in Ireland probably don't realize people still do that. You know, the kind of radicals you're used to hearing it in relation to IWW back in 1910.
But. Oh, yeah. Oh, people still fetishize that completely. So, but basically, I think around the time that I was 19 and I got really burnt on organizing, I'd been, like, involved in various anarchist projects for, like, 3 or 4 years at that point, and was just really frustrated with a lot of stuff. I left New York City, and I hitchhiked with a friend of mine to Chicago for work. We had a gig set up there with, like, doing this, like, really bizarre, random electrician work, which was ridiculous since neither of us were electricians. But and that sort of kick-started, you know, so then I was in Chicago, and I didn't have any responsibilities for the first time in my life. You know, I've always had a job or, you know, and had to, you know, I had a car and I had to make payments or whatever, you know, and that kind of thing. And all of a sudden, you know, I had fled New York and was in Chicago, and I had nowhere I had to be, and I had $500 from working. And so I was like, well, maybe I'll just go to Seattle. You know, I haven't been there since, you know, the WTO protests. I'll go check it out. It was like 2000, I guess. And so I'd kind of, like, played around on freight trains when I was a kid. Like, we, you know, see one go by and we'd jump on it and see where it went or whatever, but I never really thought about it that much. And I foolishly, not recommended for youth, just jumped on a train in Chicago and ended up in Minneapolis. Like, I sort of knew, like, people, you know, that knew about it, so they said, well, if you go to this yard and you go to this place, it'll get you to Minneapolis. And so I ended up in Minneapolis, and then I met up with more people, and we all went from Minneapolis to Seattle on a freight train, which is a beautiful ride. And that's sort of when I started meeting other people who use freight trains to get around the country, and I hadn't really, like, I'd sort of heard people talk about it, but I wasn't really aware that it was such a huge, like, scene of, like, mostly, like, kind of, like, punk subcultural kids who were just, like, that's what they did. They hopped trains around the country and that kind of thing just to visit. And so I sort of ended up in the sort of, like, summit hopping circuit with, on top of that, you know, like, I didn't really feel like train hopping was revolutionary or anything like that, like some of the crime think type kids do, but, like, you know, it was fun. It was a really great vacation, and I used it to get to, you know, like, you know, around the country to different, like, you know, Los Angeles for a conference or whatever, you know, like that kind of thing. And so it was really entertaining. It's also, it can be dangerous, but it's really fun and exciting, but kind of a diversion in many ways too. Like, I think there's this romanticization among a lot of, like, the younger kids of this, like, transient lifestyle, and, like, a lot of people sort of try to make political connections to freight hopping by evoking that sort of, you know, Depression-era wobblies hopping trains or whatever kind of thing. But, I remember reading some numbers on it at some point. There's an estimated 5,000 people at any given time riding freight trains around the country, so it's a pretty huge scene of people.
You started out as an anarchist in the South.
Yeah, I lived
Carolina,
wasn't
it?
Yeah, North Carolina. I was living in Raleigh, and it was kind of like I kind of ended up with, like, sort of vague, undefined anarchist politics in some ways, just by virtue of the political punk scene, which, I mean, none of those people ever came through North Carolina and played, but, or very rarely did they, but, you know, that was, like, the most rebellious youth thing, and I was a very angry 15-year-old and all that kind of stuff. But then a series of circumstances sort of politicized things for me, where, like, one was that the person I was dating was arrested and sent to prison for, like, pretty much kind of trumped up charges. I mean, like, also familial conflict in many ways, like, sort of led me to be on my own at a pretty young age, and that was a big smack in the face. Like, I definitely didn't have that sort of romanticized notion of, you know, poverty after being a 15-year-old kid trying to find a job, living out of a car. It was really not as fun as they make it out to be in Evasion and all the crime think books out there. But, and so that sort of was a snap to the face, and also there's a lot of problems in at the time, this is like, you know, in the early to mid-90s in North Carolina, with, like, active, organized Nazi skinheads that would come out to punk shows, and they're, you know, there's, they had all these crews, and so it was kind of like a regular activity would be the fighting between the Nazis and the punks, and so that was, like, another thing that, like, you know, even people died in some of those fights. I mean, it was really, like, there was some really intense conflict. Just sort of seeing that there were people that were willing to, like, you know, stab my friend because he was black was, like, a really, you know, I mean, I was sort of familiar with racism, I knew it existed kind of thing, but, like, you know, I just didn't really have a real understanding of, like, how it played out, and seeing it play out like, that was one of the first things I did when I was about 16, was working with other sort of, you know, anti-fascist youth to organize anti-racist action, and that, like, which is, you know, I think it serves a purpose. I don't think it is the solution to the racism problem in North America, but it definitely serves a very obvious purpose in confronting organized fascists in the street, and so that was something that was also, like, sort of a political wake-up for me in many ways. And then, you know, there was, like, you know, there was a lot of the organizing in North Carolina for me at that time was really not anarchist-focused at all, because I was one of three anarchists I knew. And so, kind of, by virtue of, like, having such a, you know, minute to non-existent anarchist community, we made a lot of networks with, like, other lefty-leaning organizations. Like, one of the first campaigns that I worked on was to free Kwame Cannon. Started out as an idealist because this is the first thing I ever worked on when I was, like, 16, I guess, 15 or 16. Kwame Cannon is the son of Willamah Cannon, who was one of, I don't know if you heard about the violence in Greensboro in 1979. There was a Klan rally, and five people were shot and killed. So
there were anti-Klan protests.
Yes, it was the anti-Klan protest. So it was a rally organized by, like, you know, I think it was in conjunction with a picket or something that was happening at the time, where the Communist Party, like, was organizing, and so then the Klan was, like, there was, like, sort of back and forth between the commies and the Klan kind of thing, and so there was a Klan rally, and five anti-Klan protesters were shot and killed. Like, the Klan had brought shotguns into town, and the cops didn't do anything, really. They just watched, like five different people get shot and killed at the protests. And in response to that, there was a campaign organized where they sued the city of Greensboro, the Nazi party, because I guess they were there as well, and then, like, the Klansmen jointly in the lawsuit, and they won, which made the city of Greensboro look really bad. And so they kind of had it, and one of the organizers was a woman named Melena Cannon, and her son, okay, God, this was, keep in mind this was, like, over 10 years ago, so my memory's a little fuzzy. Her son, Kwame Cannon, was arrested, I think he was 17. If I remember correctly, he was on, like, five counts of nonviolent breaking and entering. Like, no one was home. He took, like, I think he got a total of, like, maybe $500 worth of stuff between all the places. Like, really, you know, really minor infraction. You know, he was a kid. You know, no one was hurt. That kind of thing. But when he ended up in front of the courts, they gave him two consecutive life sentences, which was just, yeah, I mean, like, what? You know, I mean, and, like, eventually over time, and this is, so I think that was in 82. And so over the next decade or so, the community was really mobilized around it. Like, it even got to the point that, like, his victims, air quotes, that, you know, he broke into their houses were even, one of them was even, like, you know, campaigning to free him, because they were like, he's been in prison for 10 years since he was 17, like, you know, and so, and there was even, like, a march from where people walked from Greensboro to Raleigh, which is, like, an hour and a half drive. And so, you know, and there was, that was one of the things that we were, like, sort of involved with organizing, like, you know, feeding it and, like, the march and, like, you know, coordinating with people and stuff. And so that was, like, a really, you know, that was, you know, so, and most of the people that were organizing around it was, like, very faith-based campaign. It was a lot of, like, preachers and, like, people who, like, you know, were tied to the community in Greensboro that Kwame was from, and but they were the people doing the radical organizing, and in my eyes, there weren't any anarchists there. But I became an idealist because in, I guess it was 98, they really, like, the governor pardoned him and released him, and so it was like, or released him into house arrest, they commuted his sentence, actually, I think. And so, you know, I was like, oh, well, so if you just organize, then you win. And, like, I was really inspired by that, and, but then after, like, a a couple years later was when I got really exhausted. I just kind of threw myself into things too much after when I turned, I guess when I was about the time I turned 18 or so, a little bit after that, circumstances sort of led me to want to get out of North Carolina for a lot of reasons. I moved to Baltimore, Maryland, lived there for almost a year, and then split to New York, and that's when I sort of started my, like, you know, traveling around for, like, which I did for about 2 years of just sort of, like, checking out. You know, I spent a month or two in all these different cities and checking it out, and it was, you know, great, great fun, nice vacation, but eventually I just kind of came to the conclusion that if you really want to do something, you have to live somewhere. You know, you have to be grounded in a community if you want to organize it. And so I went home to North Carolina and lived there for another 2 years before I moved to Austin.
And in terms of stuff you're currently involved in, so one of the things is the Industrial Workers of the World. Quite mm-hmm. a lot of the people I've talked to have been involved in the IWW. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
I think that I have a very complicated relationship with the IWW. I was really involved in Austin, but there was an organizing campaign at the co-op grocery there that I worked at for a few years that was, you know, despite our best efforts, like, I really feel like I learned a lot from that organizing campaign. We just, I don't know whether we just didn't sort of inoculate the other workers well enough into what to expect or, you know, what our failing was exactly. But it ended up, you know, we went from, you know, we had some really good solid build-up, and the IWW was really instrumental. The organizing there was specifically around this group called the Wheatsville, that's the co-op, the Wheatsville Workers Action Campaign. Because, you know, the first times I started having conversations with people, I'd say, oh, I'm in a union, I'm in the IWW, and they're like, union? Isn't that the mafia? And, like, you know, aren't they gonna try and take $5,000 a month from dues? I mean, these people had really wacky notions about what a union or even, you know, or what the IWW was. And so, you know, we kind of started out with, like, the Wheatsville Workers Action Campaign for people to get involved in. And then from that, about 10 or 15 people joined the IWW. But our campaign failed for many reasons. I think a lot of it was that its co-op groceries are, like, a really unique, or cooperative anything is a really unique thing to try and organize, because both the customers and the workers have this really idealized view of it. Oh, it's a cooperative, you know, we all own it, or whatever, and it's, you know, I mean, no, there's still a boss. He still makes, you know, I mean, he made, like, something like 70 grand a year, where most people were making $6 an hour. You know, it's just, like, really, the dynamics that exist are sort of masked by this concept that, you know, I mean, in their mission statement, it was, like, social justice this, and blah, blah, blah. We have fair trade stuff. We can't treat our workers badly. You know, it's just very, very adept at marketing itself. You know, I mean, they even actually went to the Whole Foods lawyers to get advice on busting the union, which obviously was very effective since all of us are fired and things didn't really work out. But I really feel like the IWW strategy for that had a lot of potential, like, just really focusing on, like, the organizing on the shop floor and building, like, worker power. I think that there was just a few, like, tactical errors on our part, like, and I feel like we need to sort of work on retention a little bit more. Like, once we had somebody on board, there wasn't really good systems in place to keep them engaged. Like, everybody who joined from that campaign, by the time 3 months after we gave up on it, none of them have shown up to, you know, so I think that that's, like, one of the main obstacles right now with the IWW is, like, leadership development sort of within the like, people that we, you know, organize with, and, like, retaining them and keeping them on board, which is why I'm excited to see the organizing department develop, and I think that that work is some of the most important work in the union right now, is, like, you know, actually having a department for organizing and focusing on it. I don't know, we had, a kind of rough patch after there was a decision made at General Assembly that basically offended many of the people in our branch, which really just, like, you know, and they felt really disempowered by the decision because of the way that GA is structured and the way that that particular situation went down. There was just a lot of frustration, and so we lost some really solid organizers who really have been committed to the IWW for a while, and now there's not even an Austin branch anymore, unfortunately. But I think that there's many, you know, we're talking about the high turnover rate of anarchists, mm-hmm. like, that exists for the IWW as well, I think. Like, there's a lot of people who cycle in and out of it, and we have some problems with retention, but I also see a lot of potential. As much as I'm a cynic, I also, like, have some high hopes for the IWW as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I picked up as I've been traveling around and speaking to and talking to people is that the American anarchist movement definitely has this problem of people being active for, say, 2 to 5 years mm-hmm. and then dropping out mm-hmm. stuff and vanishing. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that happens?
Well, I think that there's a couple of reasons. One thing that I feel like I've run into is that a lot, like, there's kind of like a wide, it also kind of depends on your definition of anarchist in many ways, because if you want to cast like a really wide net for that, I think that there's a good portion of the people that identify as anarchists, like, kind of do it as more out of, like, cultural familiarity than, like, political identity, if that makes sense. Like, their friends are all anarchists, they listen to anarchist punk, you know, anarchists have really good fashion sense, or, you know, whatever, like, they're surrounded by them, so they sort of identify as an anarchist while they go through their, like, rebellious phase in their teens and 20s, but then it doesn't really serve, like, you know, serve the community, the purpose of a community very well, because it's, like, not based around a community, like, you know, there's just the sort of amorphous identity of an anarchist, North American anarchist community, but it doesn't really have all the mechanisms that a community really has, so eventually they become disillusioned with the community side, or disillusioned with the lack of, like, consistent organizing, and so they just sort of, you know, oh, well, you know, I'm out of my rebellious phase now, and they sort of move on from it. And so I think that that's not just, like, I don't think that's, like, necessarily a failing on the part of anarchism. I think it's, like, the problem is that, like, a lot of why people get involved in it, what their reason is for really committing to it, and if they even committed to it. I think another part of the problem is that it's exhausting. I mean, people reinvent the wheel every year. I mean, that's, like, you know, I've been involved in some project or another for over 10 years now, and it's just, like, you know, I try this, I almost sound like I'm not even old, but I sound like a cranky old lady who's just like, oh, you kids, you're doing it again, just like, that's not how you do this, I know how to do this, but, I mean, it's because people just make the same mistakes over and over and over. There's not really, like, because there's such high turnover and because, you know, people drop out after 2 to 5 years, when the same project gets invented in the same city again 3 years later, no one from the previous project is there to say, no, we tried that, it didn't work, you know, and so I think that, you know, it could be really exhausting. I mean, most of the people that I was friends with, you know, when I first started getting involved in anarchism, are not active anymore. You know, they're still sort of on the fringes, like, where they're, you know, friends with all these anarchists, and they, you know, go to anarchist shows or conferences or something, maybe to hang out with people, but they're not really organizing anymore, and I think it's exhausting to just be beating your head against the wall over and over, and not really seeing a lot of product at the end of it. You know, I think that, like, when you win something, it makes it all worthwhile, and it gives you energy to, like, go and beat your head, because I can beat my head against the wall for, like, several, you know, years, if eventually I start seeing cracks in that wall, but that's something that, you know, anarchists are sometimes not that great at winning, and so we don't have, like, that sort of revitalization over here that's, like, and I think that's part of why, I mean, when you see the, like, you know, just blow-up of organizing after the WTO protest was because, you know, people saw that, and they saw it as a win for anarchists, and so all of a sudden, everybody wanted to be an anarchist, and it was, like, really exciting, but then there wasn't another, you know, another win after that, really, and so that's, you know, then eventually people faded out and got involved in whatever it is that they're involved in now.
I mean, one of the interesting kind of observations I have of noting that is that before I started the tour, my exposure to North American anarchism was mostly in terms of online stuff,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things is there's lots of hostility to the idea of formal organization,
mm-hmm.
and people are going, oh, I can't have organization for organization, send a thing, blah, 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 and then actually, touring, I'm going, wow, you know, you could really do with some organization for organization's sake, so that when, you know, a project comes up, you have people who did it 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
15 years mm-hmm. ago, 20 years ago, and can give some idea of how things might turn out. Because this, you know, it's like watching a hamster in a wheel.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, it's just this continuous cycle of things going round and round. And you have I've had pretty much the same conversations
mm-hmm.
with people in every city I've been to.
Absolutely.
In terms of how that works.
Well, yeah, but, you know, the youth don't want to listen to the you know, old farts who are living in the past, and it's not the 1800s anymore, dude. We're on to, like, the new stuff or whatever. Yeah, no, I mean, but that's, I think another problem is that there's such a, people don't really think about it because they think that once they identify as an anarchist, they've release themselves from the trappings of American, like, culture and all the flaws in it or whatever, but there is a really intense individualist streak, especially, I mean, in North American anarchism, absolutely, but, you know, and also in, like, the greater society that people, like, have to actively be thinking about to, like, work on, and I think that, you know, we're talking about the dues conversation the other day, like, I think that's, like, a perfect example of, like, how North American anarchists, or maybe the Canadians don't want me to lump them in, and Mexicans probably, okay. United States, anarchists, like, have a really big problem with, you know, sort of combating, like, this individual, although many of them think individualism is, like, rad and awesome and woohoo the ego, but, like, there's definitely a problem with, you know, when we were trying to institute dues in organizations, people have this really big resistance to it because they see it almost like a tax or something, and they want to know, like, well, if I have to give up something, what am I going to get out of it? And it's just this really, like, you know, me, like, what am I going to get kind of concept, which, I mean, like I said the other day, you know, people with, like, really solid, like, people that I respect who have, like, really solid, you know, political theory and all kind of stuff, it doesn't translate very well into their own life because they're really resistant. I mean, the IWW tried to raise dues and that got crushed, you know, people were really resistant to it, and, you know, the idea of a dues-paying anarchist organization is, like, I mean, people will call that oppressive. You know what I mean? That's, like, you know, if you get on InfoShop and you try and talk about, like, you know, we want formal structure and dues and accountability, people will be like, stop trying to, you know, oppress me, dude. You're just like the government or something, and they call you authoritarian. And it's really, you know, through... I've never left the United States. I've never even been to Canada. But, like, through those internet forums I've been talking to other people about in the last, like, year or so... it's really been a wake-up call to how incredibly different the, like, internal culture of anarchism is in the United States versus other places where, like, 5% dues are just like, yeah, it's 5% dues. Here people would, like, the anarchists would have little mini riots against other anarchists if you tried to instill 5% dues. That's so repressive and it's like Stalin or something. I mean, it's really incredible how people just react so intensely to, like, yeah, to organization and to getting stuff done.
In terms of organization, you're involved in trying to set up a new organization in the Northwest called Class Action Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
Want to tell us what you're trying to achieve with that?
In some ways, it's kind of interesting because, you know, here I'm, you know, obviously something of an outsider coming in, and I'm not trying to, like, be like, I have the path, but it's kind of similar to some conversations I was having with people in Texas that I think just sort of the need for, like, a specific organization of anarchists in, like, we're shooting for Washington, Oregon, with a, like, kind of a unitary model for organization. And I think that, and, like, with the idea being, like, you know, we're loosely based on the Anarchismo statement. Like, our founding conference is June 7th, and so we'll have, like, more solid stuff come out of that. But, you know, we're kind of, like, you know, so far that's what we've been based around is, like, here's the Anarchismo statement. Are you interested? Then you should, you know, keep in touch with us. We're trying to develop these ideas. And I think that it particularly makes sense for the Northwest, which my impression is, from the people that I know that have been, like, around the Northwest for a while, is that it tends to be, like, people who are really solid anarchists that are actually, like, kind of sticking with it rather than it being a phase of youth rebellion or something, is that eventually there's so many cycles of anarchist organizations that sort of disappear or whatever that they end up being, like, doing, you know, being involved in some kind of mass work or other, and being anarchists, and not having any, but that's it. You know, they don't have any connections to, like, any kind of anarchist organization or community,
yeah,
or...
they're involved in community organizing,
yeah,
or union organizing.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think it's, like, a really logical place here to be building, a specific anarchist organization for, you know, developing, like, you know, like, a, you know, theoretically, you know, politically, internally, and then also, you know, bringing that out into all the mass work that people are already doing, and, you know, and just having that, you know, back and forth. And so I'm really, you know, we're moving really slowly. We're not trying to recruit everyone who calls himself an anarchist in the Northwest into our, you know, enlightened anarchist organization, mostly because of, I think, from the time that I've spent around the United States, I think there's the most diverse definition of anarchists in the Northwest more than anywhere else. Like, there's definitely, I think that it's improved somewhat in the last few years, but definitely, like, the dominant tendency of anarchism in the Northwest is green anarchism or insurrectionary anarchism, with this really sort of lack of political cohesion around that. Like, there's not even really, like, most of the people that I met when I was in, like, I spent a lot of time in, like, Portland and Eugene and that kind of stuff, and the people that I would meet were kind of just like, you know, I believe in green anarchism because I think that the anarchist communists suck at the environment. And there wasn't even necessarily, like, you know, a really deep political understanding of what that meant to be a green anarchist. And so I think it would be helpful for this region of the country to see a, like, an organization of anarcho-communist type folks who are, like, solidly engaged in organizing with, like, around the environment. Like, I think that there's a whole realm of environmental issues that the green anarchists don't even touch, which is, like, centered around working class organizing. Like, there's definitely, in the South, you see a lot of that, like, you know, like, environmental racism is a huge problem. There's a lot of people who organize, like, in the working class for environmental reasons, but up here, it seems like the sort of environmentalist anarchist movement is very, like, sort of self-involved and kind of, like, focused on, how do I phrase this, like, the dominant tendency leans towards direct action against corporations or against, you know, loggers or whatever, like, that kind of stuff, and there's not really as much of a class analysis to it, which I think is really lacking, because I think that there's a really obvious connection between the working class and environmentalism, since the working class is the most affected by pollution and by all these, like, environmental concerns that the green anarchists have, but they're, you know, so I think that there's a lot of room for anarcho-communist type organizing around here to that will really link a lot of these issues together and you know, hopefully will, you know, be well established and stick around for a while, and maybe some of the green anarcho types that just really arbitrarily hate anarcho-communists will maybe come around a little bit and change their mind about it.
Just do use the phrase environmental racism, which I'm guessing may not be familiar to people in Ireland, but that, mm-hmm. that in a simple form, that basically describes their tendency to locate the town dump in mm-hmm. Overwhelmingly black neighborhoods.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, you know, I'm not terribly familiar with the you know, issues of race around Ireland, but in the United States, like, there's definitely people, like, tend to talk about race and class sort of interchangeably, which I think is flawed in many ways, but it's also due to, like, the disproportionate amount of black and Latino folks who are in the working class versus their, like, how much space they take, you know, or what's the word, like, their numbers in general. Like, you know, so it's often, like, there definitely is a tendency of, like, people sort of to forget that, like, the majority of the working class is white, but that's also because, like, the people who are in, like, the biggest crunch tend to be, like, people of color who are working class. And so that's the neighborhoods, you know, like, that they want to put the dumps in and put the, you know, like, you know, North Carolina, talking about the hog farms and all that kind of stuff. It's, like, usually in, like, poor neighborhoods of, like, black folks is where the biggest problems end up dropped in their lap. Yeah, I think that, like, it can be somewhat misleading, the environmental racism, if you're not, like, aware of racist mm-hmm. politics in the United States. And, I mean, in Texas, I was really involved in a lot of, like, direct action AIDS organizing, which I think is sort of a neglected issue among anarchists in many ways, which I think is really interesting because there's this, like, sort of romance that a lot of American anarchists or U.S. anarchists have of you know, the most marginalized people in the community, that's where we need to be. But, and, like, that's one of the things that I, you know, one of my other anarchist friends that we both were, like, really heavily involved in AIDS organizing sort of, like, cynically chuckled about was that, you know, well, here they are, but you know, where are the anarchists? You know, they're not really there. And so we were involved for a few years in an organization called ACT UP, which is modeled on direct action organizing around AIDS from the 80s and 90s. It started in New York City. It was like a response to the lack, complete and utter lack of action around AIDS by the government. You know, I mean, it was 7 years before Reagan, the president at the time, you know, even used, like, addressed it in public at all. And so there was, like, you know, there was no research happening for medication. There was no, you know, prevention programs, nothing. There was nothing going on. Like, basically everything that goes on around AIDS is from, like, organized action. But basically what happened, like, so most of the people, in my impression from reading histories and stuff like that, is, like, that a lot of the people who were doing the organizing, particularly in New York, but there's also, you know, in the Bay, were sort of, like, upper middle class, like, wealthier white gay men. And, you know, and so a lot of gains were made. You know, there's, you know, a lot of research is a huge multi-billion dollar industry at this point. You know, like, the pharmaceutical industries are really racking it in. And, but so what happened was that, you know, first of all, like, a huge portion of that movement was lost to AIDS, and then a lot of other people sort of, once that they could, you know, they got, okay, now we have some medication that's, like, somewhat acceptable, there was, like, a little bit of stagnation in that movement. And so recently there's been something of a resurgence. I look for my inspiration much more to the Philly chapter of ACT UP, which is much more focused on issues of race and class, which ACT UP traditionally was not. Like, the people who are disproportionately affected by HIV are very much the people who can't afford the medication, who, like, don't have access to prevention, who, you know, like, these, you know, people who are just completely disenfranchised to begin with. And so that's a lot more of the leadership in ACT UP in Philadelphia reflects that a lot more, I think, than it does in New York, for example, that chapter. And so there's been sort of this resurgence and a lot of activity around that, which was really interesting in Austin because you know, people don't even like to talk about sex in Texas, much less, you know, things you can get from sex or whatever. And so we had a brief campaign, well, not brief, it was long, but it really ended up being kind of unsuccessful, where we were trying to organize to take condoms off the contraband list in Texas prisons, because we thought that it was, like, a really, like, a vital opportunity for, like, prevention. Like, so many positive folks end up in prison because they're at this sort of intersection of, like, all these, like, identities that, you know, end up in prison. It seemed like a really, like, important area to address. For me, I feel like it was really important, too, because there's this sort of, we neglect people in prisons. We forget about them. We don't, you know, it's not only, like, I think both in organizing, because it's so exhausting to organize around prison issues, because it's this huge behemoth, you know, it's like akin to trying to fight capitalism. It's just like, oh my god, this is enormous, how can I possibly overcome it? But also, you know, just in society in general, there's, you know, people just, you lock them up and you ignore it. I mean, 1 in every 100, you know, people in North America is, or in the United States, are in prison, in the prison system somehow, and it's just, and, you know, 1 in every 3 black men is involved in some way, like, you know, in parole, probation, in prison. I mean, it's a huge, huge problem in the United States that really gets neglected. A lot of the AIDS organizing in particular is, like, really focused around, like, sort of the shinier issues. Like, and so we really, like, we want to talk about, like, harm reduction and like, and the people who are just sort of getting neglected in prison. And so we had this multi-pronged approach. We had, like, direct pressure being put on the executive director of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Some folks were engaged in, like, introducing a bill, which I just had no interest in because I knew it would fail, and I, you know, whatever. And then there was also, like, attempts to start, like, a pilot program in a jail, because that's how it's happened in other, there are other, like, in San Francisco and Los Angeles and D.C. and I think Vermont and Mississippi, there's other places that don't have Canada, you know, condoms are in prison, you know, and so we really, like, tried to point out, like, all the areas where programs exist, no one's ever complained about it, because they, you know, the big argument on the part of the prisons is either sex doesn't happen in prison, which is obviously a lie. What else is there? Oh, that it would be, they'd be used as weapons, which I thought was really hilarious, like, you know, a condom slingshot, I don't know, and that it would be condoning sexual behavior, which very much reflected the attitudes towards youth and how we can't teach them about sex, because if we talk to them about it, that's telling them to go do it or something. And so it really, you know, so we worked really hard to, like, sort of combat those myths and stuff. And so that was, like, it was a really exhausting campaign that ended up, I think we set our sights a little too high with that, but it was, like, it was also really sort of empowering to be taking a direct approach to it versus what had sort of ended up happening from all the activism in the 80s and 90s that was very grassroots-led, that was very, very radical, like, that lots of anarchists were involved in. That all that organizing in the 90s and 2000s ended up getting sort of subverted into nonprofit work, and that's, like, everyone just got involved in nonprofit work to the point that, like, direct action organizations are novel. And when people would be like, you do ACT UP in Austin? Oh my god, tell me everything. Because the only thing that exists, like, all of our networking was with, you know, nonprofit organizations who are doing stuff. And so I learned a lot from that work, and I thought it was definitely really interesting, even though it was very, very exhausting.
So the question I'm traditionally ending the interviews with is asking people what they make of the whole electoral circus at the moment, in particular the Obama versus Clinton thing that is still going on.
Oh god, I'm so tired. It's gotten to the point where, like, even The Daily Show can't make me laugh at it anymore. I'm just sick of it. The thing that bothers me whenever I hear coverage of it at this point is that there are so many people, I hear about all these people who, like, were sort of, like, you know, on some kind of path towards, I see them as, like, logically ending up in anarchism, but they get, now they're getting diverted. You know what I mean? I think, like, that's definitely true in Texas, where there's, like, a lot of people, Libertarian Party in Texas has ruined anarchism. I mean, that's an extreme take, but, like, you know, you see these people who are, like, logically, like, suspicious of the government, and they get sort of sucked into the, like, 9/11 truth movement or Libertarian, you know, party, like, we love capitalism, rah-rah movement. But, and I feel like the same thing is now happening with the election, where people, like, who have these, like, really, like, developing, like, some solid, like, race and class and gender analysis are getting sort of distracted by, like, oh my god, look, progress is being made. The ruling class now has a little bit of color and, you know, some boobs or something, you know, just, like, really distracted by you know, supposed progress by our president potentially could be. I mean, it's just, it's so frustrating. But I think that, like, I think that there would have been potential to have some really good, solid political conversations post the Bush administration, like the post-Bush administration election, that could have centered around, like, you know, concrete, real issues that instead now are being diverted into talking about, like, race and gender, you know, and so that's a big focus rather than talking about, like, whew, God, the last 8 years sure have sucked, huh? Let's talk about, you know, some other, you know, ways to run things, you know, I mean, that's, like, you know, that would be a perfect inroad to, like, talking to my family about politics, like, just and the people I went to high school with and that kind of thing. But now, the only thing anyone can talk about is, like, Obama and Hillary and who's going to win and what's going to happen and all that kind of stuff. So, I'm pretty much just sick of it. I feel like there's not, I haven't thought of a good way to use it as, like, any kind of, like, conversational tool or organizational tool. I mean, I'm sure that it exists, like, on a small scale, but I'm pretty much just ready for the election to be over, whoever wins. Great, fine, let's move on, I'm done with it, and let's, like, get back to, like, the real issues, and rather than talking about these sort of meta-discussions around, you know, presidential elections.